Hi, you are listening to DNA Dialogues, where we dive into the intricate world of genetic counseling research. I'm Kate Wilson.
I'm Kalita Leopold.
I'm Naomi Wagner.
And we are your co-hosts.
Join us as we peel back the layers of groundbreaking articles from the Journal of Genetic Counseling, bringing you exclusive discussions with the authors themselves.
Each episode sparks a vibrant exchange, exploring the latest discoveries, ethical dilemmas, and technological advances that are shaping the future of medical genetics.
From navigating complex testing decisions to building trust with diverse communities,
listen in as we unpack the science, challenge assumptions, and celebrate the human connection at the heart of genetic counseling research.
So grab your headphones, unravel the double helix, and prepare to be captivated by the array of voices in DNA Dialogues, a podcast where the blueprint of life meets intimate human conversation. In this episode, we are exploring concepts related to the diagnostic odyssey, whole genome sequencing, and results return. Hi, I'm Naomi Wagner, and my pronouns are she, her. I am talking with Celine Lewis, she, her, about her recent Journal of Genetic Counseling paper titled The Disequilibrium of Hope, a Grounded Theory Analysis of Parents' Experiences of Receiving a No Primary Finding Result from Genome Sequencing. Dr. Celine Lewis is a behavioral scientist working in the field of genetic and genomic medicine. She is currently at University College London Institute of Child Health and is an NIHR Advanced Fellow. Her work focuses on how patients and families relate to, communicate, and make decisions around personal genetic information and the subsequent behavioral, psychological, and social outcomes. Welcome, Celine.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
So to start, I'd like to know what inspired your team to delve into the specific experience of parents receiving a no primary finding result from genome sequencing?
Well, the idea really came about during the time of the 100,000 Genomes Project. And this was a project conducted in England. It was a first of its kind project really in the world where patients and parents were able to access whole genome sequencing for diagnosis of rare disease, as well as some cancer cases. And during that project, really, a lot of the focus was on those participants who were getting a diagnosis, which was brilliant. And, you know, deservedly so, there was a lot of attention focusing on the amazing success of the 100,000 Genomes Project and whole genome sequencing technology more broadly. But really, sort of, there was very little research on the experience of those participants who don't get a result. And we know that the diagnostic yield from whole genome sequencing is anywhere between sort of 25 to 50%, depending on the clinical indication. So that tells us that actually there are still around at least half of the participants who aren't getting a result from whole genome sequencing. So we felt that it was really important to understand their experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. So how did you go about recruiting the participants for the study?
Well, here really, I have to credit my colleague and the MSc student who conducted the bulk of this work, Jana Gurasashvili. And she recruited parents through a patient organization called SWAN UK here in the UK. And SWAN stands for St. Jones Without a Name. And SWAN UK is a support group in the UK that provides a dedicated network for families of children and young adults who are affected by an undiagnosed genetic condition. And they very kindly promoted our project through their social media networks.
We've heard of lots of studies tapping into those patient advocacy groups. Seems like a great recruitment tool for many studies. Since a lot of this information you were receiving was qualitative, I'm curious if you can briefly explain the methodology employed in analyzing the data.
So for this study, we decided to use a grounded theory methodology to analyze the data. And there are sort of a number of different types of grounded theory that have evolved since it was first developed by Barney Glaser and Anselm Strauss back in the 1960s. But at its most fundamental, grounded theory is a qualitative research method that attempts to unravel the meaning of people's interactions and social actions and experiences. And most importantly, it sets out to discover or construct a theory from the data, from sort of the ground up, really. So it's very much looking at what participants say and using their quotes to develop codes and categories, and from that, a rich detailed theory that it has explanatory power.
So for this study, were you looking at pediatric and or adult populations?
So for this study, we decided that we were going to focus on pediatric populations. So the experience of parents, really, of children who are going through whole genome sequencing because they have an undiagnosed rare condition. And the reason we decided to focus on that population is because a large majority of participants taking part in the 100,000 Genomes Project were pediatric patients.
So let's dive into the data. The study highlights the emergence of two main themes, striving to solve the unsolved puzzle and navigating hope lost and found. Could you elaborate on these themes and what they signify in the context of the parents' experiences?
So the first theme that we came up with, which was striving to solve the unsolved puzzle, reflects really the lived experience for parents who have a child with no diagnosis, as well as their motivations for wanting a diagnosis and how the offer of genome sequencing raises hopes that a diagnosis will be found. So our studies and countless other studies have really shown that parents want a diagnosis for a huge number of different reasons. But a really important one is relief from guilt and validation that the parents haven't or didn't do anything wrong during their pregnancy. And it's a reason that I come across a lot in the work that I do with parents, patients and families. And there's also a drive from parents to feel that they're sort of doing everything possible that they can for their child. And we know that this is one of the reasons why so many parents agree to take part in the 100,000 Genomes Project. There's also practical reasons for parents, such as having a name for their child's condition that can make it much easier to access things like social support or disability support or support at school in terms of their child's education, and that can be really difficult without a diagnosis. So we know that, you know, there's these really strong motivational factors why parents want a diagnosis. And at the same time, what we also found in our data was that there seemed to be this inherent fear of what might be found from undergoing whole genome sequencing. So for example, what if parents found out the condition was more serious than they had previously thought, or if the condition was found to be life-limiting? So there was really kind of a push-pull factor, if you like. There was sort of a definite desire to want to solve this unsolved puzzle. But at the same time, there was a sense that of fear to some extent about what might be found. And then the second theme that we identified from the data was what we called navigating hope lost and found. And this really describes the experience of receiving a no primary finding result and the various emotions and consequences from that news. So in our data, during our interviews, parents would use words such as gutted, disappointed, broken, or deflated even for not getting a diagnosis and what that felt like, these sort of really visceral emotions and experiences that they shared with us. For some, the timing of getting a result was really bad. So for example, one parent spoke to us about getting a result just before Christmas and how that really kind of impacted the holiday period for them, finding out that they hadn't got a diagnosis from whole genome sequencing. And parents sort of talked a lot about their hopes being dashed, about being left feeling isolated once again. And in some cases, this sort of no primary finding once again sort of brought back all these feelings to the fore. So it really intensified this feeling of isolation, that their child was different to others, that their family dynamic was very different to others, and that they sort of had very few friends or family in some cases who could relate to their specific situation. And some parents talked about feeling resigned that they would never get a diagnosis. And so this is really where this role of hope came in. We found sort of initially, parents had really hoped to get a diagnosis, and then when they got the no primary finding result, this was kind of hope sort of dissipated. But what we then identified from our data was this sense that in some senses, hope sort of comes back. There's sort of a transition again, that from this sort of resignation that they might never get a diagnosis and losing hope to regaining some sense of hope again. So parents talked about having a little bit of hope or needing to hold on to hope. And what we found was that in this particular context for these particular parents, hope was almost like a comfort blanket or a crutch, which acted as a support mechanism for parents really like a coping mechanism, one could say. And in some instances, parents also talked about sort of hoping that the technology would improve, that science was progressing, and that what we perhaps don't understand today about genes and genetics, we might understand in the future. So one could never completely rule out the fact that one might get a diagnosis. So it was really about sort of how important this role of hope is.
And the proposed theory from your study is termed the disequilibrium of hope. Can you explain this theory in more detail and discuss its implications for understanding this emotional journey of the parents in this genome sequencing process?
So yes, we called the theory the disequilibrium of hope. And I have to credit my co-author, Sergio Silverio, here for coming up with this wonderful name. And it's a theory which tries to capture the ups and downs, the emotional roller coaster, the peaks and the troughs that so many of these parents were experiencing on their diagnostic journey. There's the up, the highs, the really hopeful attitudes in terms of the potential for a diagnosis. And then the sort of sense of deflation when hopes are dashed on receiving a no primary findings result. And then, like I was saying earlier, the sort of re-emergence of hope. So hope was found to sort of come back, but perhaps in a more muted or dulled form. So really, the theory describes this roller coaster of hope across this trajectory, this sort of patient journey. And essentially what we found overall through this research is how important hope is for these parents throughout their journey. It was central to all our participants' experiences, but it was very dynamic. So it changed, it had different roles. It was both a motivation, but also a coping mechanism. So in that sense, we found hope to be a cognitive process. It was always there by our participants' side throughout their journey. And because of this, I think what this highlights is the importance of acknowledging its presence and working with this hope so that it has a functional role as well as an emotional role.
And you've mentioned this emotional roller coaster for parents and families. I'm curious, based on your research, do you have any suggestions for pre as well as post-test counseling for the families undergoing genome sequencing?
Yes, I mean, a really important question. And really, the crux of what all the work that I do and we do as sort of behavioral scientists and researchers. So how do we use this information to improve the lives of patients and families? So I think what I would say in answer to that question is a lot of it is about managing expectations at the outset. So at the time that the test is offered, explaining to parents perhaps what the diagnostic yield is, explaining that they might not get a result, explaining why they might not get a result, and perhaps also helping parents to explore how they might feel if they don't get a result, if they get a no findings result. We found, I think that the literature tells us that hope has an important psychological function, for example, helping to combat demoralization. And therefore, it's important that parents don't give up on hope for a diagnosis, even if they get a no primary findings result from whole genome sequencing. So rather than parents letting go of hope, perhaps it's really a time of letting go of old hopes and taking up new ones. And this is a process in the literature referred to as hope refinement. So this idea of reframing hope. And one practical suggestion that we give in the paper for how this might be done in practice is for health professionals to perhaps ask a question such as, in light of this new information we now have, what are you hoping for now? It might also be helpful to include ways of promoting hope that focus on healthcare and health. So different ways that parents might be able to access research or trials, discussing the continued medical support that's still available for their child despite not having a diagnosis, as well as any practical support there is for parents. So things like respite services, social support, support groups, and also promoting health and psychological well-being for the parents, so helping identify ways of managing stress or if there's any access to psychological support for parents as they go through this particularly difficult time. I think the other key thing as well is health professionals highlighting what we do know about the child's condition and what information we do have, and that even without a diagnosis, there's still a lot that we can do to support that child and to support parents. I think it's also really important that parents have a named point of contact within their medical team, within their genetics department, for example, as well as highlighting the continued regular appointments with the medical team that that child will still have access to monitor progress and discuss any advances in the world of genetics.
Those are all great suggestions from the research. I'm curious, any additional resources or support specifically to those with the no primary finding?
So some parents said that they felt their isolation could have been alleviated somewhat if they'd received some information up front about how many people, in fact, don't get a diagnosis from whole genome sequencing, and that this might have made them feel less alone. And this is really important because, like I was saying at the beginning, a large number of parents won't get a diagnosis. In fact, probably around half. So these parents shouldn't feel alone. There are going to be countless other parents that are going to be going through the same thing that they are. I think another point that it would be worth highlighting is the ongoing developments that are taking place in genomics. It's advancing at such a huge speed, and we're understanding more and more about the role and function of different genes all the time, and as genes are added to panels. So there's always the opportunity that the genome can be reanalyzed and that new information might come to light for these parents. I think signposting parents to external resources, patient organizations such as SWAN UK, that might be helpful for parents in coping with a no primary finding result. I've talked about having a named point of contact, having regular clinic appointments to mind a child's progress, as well as a follow-up plan for those children who don't get a result, for the potential to sort of do the reanalysis to see if something new comes up. So this topic of reanalysis, I think it's really important to address that when family receive a no primary finding result. I think also what's really key is to highlight that a diagnosis is not a magic wand, and that even with a diagnosis, there's often still symptom management, as there's often no specific cure or treatment for that child. So in reality, it often doesn't always make a substantial difference to that patient and to that family when a child gets a diagnosis, because sometimes the conditions are so rare that there isn't really very much information available about the condition, and parents are still left with a lot of uncertainties and unanswered questions even with the diagnosis. So I think that is really important information that needs to be relayed to.
I know we discussed that this study was focused on pediatric patients. I'm curious, are there any specific populations or contexts that you believe warrant further investigation based on the findings?
So most of the children in our study had quite significant and complex needs, and therefore the impact of not getting a diagnosis was potentially quite profound for this particular group. All of our parents had had previous experience of going through genetic testing and had been searching for a diagnosis from anything between 4 and 15 years. So really our theory is very specific to a particular group of parents in this particular context. So I think what would be really interesting would be to understand the experiences perhaps of those parents who are coming to genomic testing for the first time.
It's interesting you called out that all of the children in this study did have a previous experience of other genetic testing. I'm curious, moving forward, do you think it is going to be more common that people are going to be doing genome sequencing as their first genetic test as part of the diagnostic odyssey?
Well, yeah, in England now, for the last few years, we've been rolling out the NHS Genomic Medicine Service. And this is really the continuation, if you like, of the 100,000 Genomes Project. But rather than a research project, patients and families are now able to access whole genome sequencing as a first-line test in certain cases. So this means that for certain clinical indications, patients will be offered whole genome sequencing, and that might be through genetics, but also through other non-genetic specialists, so pediatrics or community pediatrics or pediatric neurology, et cetera, et cetera. So what's really exciting, I suppose, in England is that we're now able to really utilize whole genome sequencing technology as a first-line test for parents who previously would have had to have waited many years to get sort of this to this stage and perhaps find a diagnosis. So our hope is that we will be able to get a diagnosis faster and for more parents than we've been able to do up until now.
That's great. And is there anything else you'd like to share about potential future directions or other things about this study before we close?
So what we've been able to show through this study is the profound impact for parents of not getting a diagnosis from whole genome sequencing. And I think it'd be really interesting to do further research really now about how we best support these patients and families who don't get a diagnosis and what follow-up care we should be offering them. And I guess the final thing, if I could just end on saying sort of thank you really to everyone that was involved in this study. So the co-authors, Jana Gurasashvili, Sergio Silverio, Melissa Hill, Michelle Peter, Bethany Stafford-Smith, and also in particular to thank Swan UK and Lauren Roberts for helping with recruitment, and of course the parents who took part in this study and were really so honest and open with us and enabled us to come to do this study and to be able to identify these important learning points from this body of work.
Thank you so much for sharing about this article today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to DNA Dialogues. Would you like to nominate a Journal of Genetic Counseling article for the show? If so, please check out the episode notes or our website for a nomination submission form. Multiple entries are welcome, and you can nominate articles written by yourself, your colleagues, or anyone you'd love to hear from. We can't wait to highlight more research from JOGC on DNA Dialogues. Welcome, Lucas and Amanda. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
Hi, Naomi. Thanks.
So let's start at the beginning. Why did you choose to look into secondary findings in particular?
This review was really driven by the fact that our work really centers around secondary findings. Lucas and I both work for a program called My Research Results, where we partner with researchers to offer genetic counseling to research participants where a secondary finding has been found by research testing. And when I talk about secondary findings, I mean something that's generally medically actionable, but that's unrelated to the reason that the person signed up for the research. So a good example is often someone might sign up to a biobank just because they're invited, not for any particular reason, but the researchers might find a BRCA variant, for example. A lot of researchers don't feel comfortable talking to people about genetic results because that's not what they've been trained to do necessarily. So our program was set up to help bridge that gap and get that information back to the research participants so they can use this genetic information to manage their health. So from working in the secondary findings space, we started looking at the literature. We saw quite a few papers about secondary findings start to be published. So it looked like there were people interested in this topic. And from speaking to researchers, we knew that a lot of people had a lot of questions about how to talk to people about secondary findings, how should we manage them. So we thought it'd be great to do a deep dive into the papers around secondary findings, and that's how our review came about.
I know that this paper is a systematic review, and I'm curious if you can share more about the methods employed, particularly concerning the selection criteria for the studies and the search strategies that were used.
I can talk about the methodology that we use. So being a systematic review, there's a systematic approach or a structure in place. And what we're guided by is guidelines, for example, like the PRISMA statement, which really outlines the steps of how to conduct a systematic review. And this is commonly used by other researchers as well when conducting systematic reviews, but essentially outlining the steps of conceptualization, screening, synthesis and analysis of data there. But it's in summary, though, to kind of talk about the inclusion and exclusion criteria or our selection criteria, how we developed that. So initially, through conversations with Amanda and our team, we really started to kind of look at our research question. What were we asking? We wanted to look at what papers we wanted to include and think about a strategy, what type of keywords to include, and what databases to target. So with the help of a librarian as well, we developed this strategy in the best way to try and pull the most relevant papers to, again, answering our question. A common framework that's used with developing inclusion, exclusion criteria or selection criteria is called a PICOS framework. And that stands for population, intervention, comparator outcome, and study design. So looking at our systematic review, our population was around focusing on adult genetic research participants. Our intervention, or what we were looking at, was the return of secondary findings, particularly from genomic and whole exome sequencing studies. Our outcomes were around uptake and the different types of outcomes, psychological, clinical, behavioral outcomes. And then the study design as well, looking at what type of papers did we want to include in our systematic review, quantitative, qualitative, as well as mixed methods, whereas we were wanting to exclude perhaps what's called grey literature or papers or studies that haven't been peer reviewed as such. So that gave really solid criteria for us to be able to then compare against the studies that we were reviewing. Did it meet that criteria or did it not? Do we include it or do we exclude it?
I imagine there's quite a few papers, many, many in the literature that would be on this topic. I'm curious, in the end, how many studies were ultimately included and how were you able to synthesize data from these varied papers with different methods?
Excellent question. There was many studies. I think initially in our search that we pulled, there was about 3,900 papers, and then deduplicating that and the different stages of screening, a process of refinement, we were left with about 29 papers in the end, or 29 studies that really answered our research question around the uptake and outcomes of secondary findings. But yeah, you are right. There's very many papers out there and diverse as well in the study designs. And so it can be challenging in how do we analyze that data? How do we bring it together? And so what we used as a part of that framework or approach to analyzing that data was what we call a narrative synthesis. And so this is a framework developed by a group of researchers, Pape et al., around about 2006. But this is a framework that can be used in systematic reviews, allowing the researcher to be able to synthesize and collate findings, especially from different types of research. And so for us, we had quantitative studies, qualitative studies, and mixed methods. So it was a process of initially organizing that data by study description and design, mapping out those outcomes and those measures. We used an Excel sheet for that to be able to keep track of all those papers, and then analyze the quantitative data and explore that with graphical representations in the review, whereas the qualitative data we're able to explore a bit more thematically and to be able to address those specific outcomes that we were looking at. So again, it's bringing all that together to create a bit of a narrative or synthesis of those findings in a story form there.
What were the findings, especially regarding the uptake of secondary findings among research participants? What did you find in the review?
One of the things that I found quite interesting was how variable the uptake was that was reported across a lot of the studies. It was kind of ranged from 20% to 97%. So, I mean, that's a huge range, you know, whether or not people wanted to find out about these secondary findings. Although we did find that a lot of studies tended to be at the higher end, kind of reporting uptake of around 60% or more. And this was pretty consistent with our experience actually returning secondary findings in the Australian settings. We have found that people seem to be quite motivated to find out when they're offered this type of genetic information. Something that was of particular interest to us was also that the studies that reported some of the highest uptake tended to be the ones that had genetic counsellors involved in returning those secondary findings to the participants. So we do wonder whether there's something about involving a genetic counsellor in the process that does impact on people's uptake of secondary findings.
I know the review highlights multiple categories of outcomes related to receiving the secondary findings. Can you elaborate on these different outcomes?
Yeah, multiple outcomes that we focused on. And the main ones that we divided outcomes into about four categories of psychological outcomes, clinical outcomes, lifestyle and behavioural outcomes, as well as family outcomes. So psychological outcomes, we were really interested in how these studies reported participants adjusting to this information, how they received it, the emotional impact, responses and thoughts. Interestingly, majority of the studies reported minimal distress and no regret from those participants, which was really encouraging to see, as well as a few other studies also reported there was no significance or significant difference in anxiety, depression or psychological burden from some of the validated measures that they used. And there, from memory as well, there was about three studies where participants did speak of initial shock and perhaps surprise hearing, you know, a secondary finding. It's not something people expect to get from research projects necessarily. But within those studies where they did follow up over a few months, those participants did report relief and actually value knowing this information. So showing that participants were able to adjust to this information and that initial shock subsided over time. So again, very encouraging to see that there was no huge psychological impact there. But the other types of the outcomes we looked at was clinical as well, where the changes to perhaps whether it's medications or changes to diagnoses, was this information communicated to physicians? Interestingly, some participants didn't report this to their primary care physician, either didn't feel comfortable or perhaps they thought their primary care physician didn't care. But it's all those little things that are really quite interesting hearing perspective there. Amanda, I was just wondering, did you want to talk a bit about the outcomes as well?
I think with the clinical outcomes, a lot of the reason for returning the secondary findings is because there are all of these health actions that people can take in response to that genetic information. So, learning about an increased risk of developing cancer means someone can engage in extra screening or risk-reducing strategies to help to manage that risk. And if you're not seeing those flow-on health benefits, then it kind of calls into the question the value of giving people that information in the first place if people don't want it so they can use it. So that was an interesting one to look at because if anything, the engagement in the health behaviours was probably lower than you would expect. It wasn't particularly high. It's hard to say how high it actually was because it did vary from study to study, and studies looked at it very much across different periods of time. And they looked at different outcomes. So it was really hard to come up with any kind of summary or overall, level of engagement. I think what we learned from looking at that data is that it's really challenging to track those kind of clinical health behavior outcomes because studies might not have the resources to do it over a period of time that you kind of need to do to let people get through, the different processes and engage with healthcare systems, which we know has lots of barriers to entry.
Definitely very interesting. And I think it's in a review, so many different things come up because there are many different papers with asking different questions with different methods. I know you both are involved with research participants and have experience returning results. I'm curious, from this review, are there any particular considerations or suggestions that these data provide that would give guidance for researchers who are returning results to participants?
One thing that we hope the review can add to what we know is just that if people do find this information valuable, and hopefully consolidating the data around this question can help to give researchers the confidence that it's okay to give this information back to people. I think across all the studies we looked at, we didn't really see people being harmed or distressed by receiving this information. And a lot of people said that there was a lot of value in it. And some people even go so far as to say they're quite grateful to have found out because, in some of the studies, they reported that the people they were returning results to wouldn't have qualified for testing under the criteria-based systems that a lot of countries have in place for genetic testing. Returning secondary findings from research is kind of an interesting alternate pathway to genetic information for people who might not otherwise have been able to find out. What we also learned is that the pathway that you choose to return it can make a real difference. It did seem like providing people with support and information was important for helping them understand it. We did see in some studies people feeling a bit uncertain or confused about their results and wanting some additional support and help to understand what it meant for them and what they need to do about it. A lot of the times a genetic counsellor can help with that, either helping to guide the researchers to set up their processes or even being involved in the process. A genetic counsellor can be a very useful person to have on your team.
I was just going to add to that as well, echoing exactly what Amanda said and touching on from what previously mentioned about the need for the researchers to be able to deliver a pathway that's patient-centered or client-centered as well when they're designing research projects, to think about that possibility of returning secondary findings. But a barrier that some of the papers reported why they didn't return secondary findings was a part of that fear process, researchers not wanting to upset participants. So I think this review has been able to show that multiple studies have reported there's no psychological burden and people have handled this information fine. In fact, they wanted it. But also another barrier that they mentioned was the loss of contact, where with studies that are ongoing, sometimes they lose participants or participants may pass away or die, and there isn't a next of kin listed. And so then there's a bit of a barrier around the processes of, well, where does this result or notification go to? So I think, yeah, developing a way to be able to maintain up-to-date details throughout the project and keeping participants engaged and accurate next of kin listed is another, I think, learning from this review that we took from.
Absolutely. Really interesting considerations for researchers to think about. Are there any particular limitations or gaps in this study or the review that you found, or ideas for future study?
Yeah, I can talk to the limitations. So majority of the papers that we included in our review, we did notice that quite a few of them were from Western countries. And so we are mindful as well that every country and healthcare system is slightly different there. And there was perhaps a weighting towards the papers coming from Western healthcare systems and perhaps research projects as well. So being mindful that as much as we can learn from this and take findings from it, of course, there's going to be unique situations in each country and what researchers take from our review there. As well, it's also interesting to keep in note that different cultures also impact healthcare systems and how results are returned there. So I suppose one limitation there that we did find was there was a heavy weighting of a lot of papers coming from Western countries. And from the papers that we explored, looking at their demographic details, while some did try to be representative of diversity, of ethnicity or ancestry, again, a lot of the papers did include a majority of white European or white ancestry as well, which isn't a new issue that's been ongoing in genetics for a while, trying to increase diversity and focus on other groups as well.
Any additional thoughts you'd like to share related to this review or your work with secondary findings for our listeners?
The systematic reviews are really useful for consolidating and really getting a good understanding of a particular area or topic. So, and it really is a deep dive into that one topic. And it's more than just kind of reading the papers. You really get a sense of the quality of the research and, you know, figuring out whether research agrees or disagrees, and also areas where more research might be needed. So I think they're really useful for the team doing the review, as well as like other people who might be reading the review, because it can also kind of signpost other really useful papers that you might want to go and look at if you're also interested in a topic. There was a lot of literature, I think Lucas mentioned, there was like over 3,000 studies that we had to screen through. And I would highlight what Lucas said about developing your research question and your scope, I think is a really important thing if you're undertaking a review, because I think that really helps you stay on the track, stay on topic and not get distracted by other things that might kind of blow your review way bigger than you expect it's going to be, because it can be very easy to, find things interesting and go down rabbit holes. But it's really important to stay true to your research question. And I think that helps you, even like when you're deciding which papers to include and exclude, does this really fit our research question? That can often help you find your way through during a review. I think Lucas's comment around the help that you can get from a librarian was a really good one. Librarians are so invaluable when you're doing systematic reviews, because they are really experts about how the databases work. They can help you with figuring out what the best search terms to use, but even beyond that, how to structure your search, how to actually use those keywords and search terms to get the best possible results from your literature search. And I think that's something that they're the kind of skills that I don't use in my day-to-day, but the librarians are much better at it than we are. So if you have access to a librarian and you're thinking about doing a systematic review, I would definitely try and engage there.
I think just adding on to that as well, the best way I found in learning how to conduct a systematic review is knowing what guidelines there are out there. So there's definitely recommended guidelines that walk you through the steps in how to conduct that systematic review, which really helped making sure I was checking off each milestone or each stage. But I think what was more valuable was actually just getting out there and reading other people's systematic reviews. I think seeing that in publication, I could see the headings, the stages, I could see a PRISMA flow chart, which is the flow chart that outlines the screening and how many papers they excluded at each stage and things like that. Was a real, I think, beneficial way to be able to visualize, okay, what does it look like conducting a systematic review? Exactly what's the end product? But I think my other finding or main takeaway from this review was that it was just highlighting the value of like genetic counselor in research from the beginning, but also in terms of consenting and the importance of pretest counseling, making sure people are aware of the possibility of secondary findings, but then also the return of results process. And like Amanda mentioned, that interesting finding that we found that a lot of the papers that had higher uptake tended to include a genetic counselor. And so I wonder if that's an interesting area to maybe explore a bit more about what difference does a genetic counselor bring participating in research. And I think we all agree that we need more genetic counselors in research as well. I think advocate and pioneer for that as well.
Awesome. Great considerations. And thank you for the immense amount of work that went through screening these articles and adding to the literature to provide this review for others in the field. We really appreciate the study and you sharing about it today on the podcast.
Thank you for your time.
You're very welcome.
Hi, I'm Janine Austin. I'm the Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of Genetic Counseling, which is proudly producing DNA Dialogues. For more information about this episode, visit dnadialogues.podbean.com, where you can also stream all episodes of the show. This same link is also in the show notes for easy access. Any questions, episode ideas, guest pitches, or comments can be sent into dnadialoguespodcast@gmail.com. Please rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever it is that you listen. This helps us climb the charts and allow other people like you to discover the show. The DNA Dialogues team includes Naomi Wagner, Khalida Leaquat, Kate Wilson, DNA Today's Kira Dineen, and myself, Janine Janine Austin. Thanks for listening to DNA Dialogues. Join us next time to explore the latest genetic counseling research.